The Guardian. Welcome to the latest Guardian.co.uk books podcast. Here's Simon Gray, author of The Smoking Diaries, reading from his new book, The Last Cigarette. For more details, go to guardian.co.uk/books.
It takes an act of will, now that we're back in London, to put on my shoes, my scarf and coat, and get down the stairs onto the pavement, where often I do a lumbering pirouette, and within a few minutes find myself back where I started, taking off my coat and shoes. Or I make it up Holland Park Avenue as far as the Renaissance, drink down two coffees at a table on the pavement, and then labour home, take off my coat. This is no life for a sentient man, or at least sentient enough to know that this is no life for him. The question arises, therefore, what can I do? To what end should I eke out my remaining days? Furthermore, the question that excited me in my adolescence, when I first came across it in the Myth of Sisyphus, why bother to eke out my remaining days? Why not just kill myself and put an end to the eking? Now, how do you answer that question, which Camus, if I remember correctly, says is the first question we should put to ourselves? Actually, I don't think that's quite how he formulates it. I think he begins by saying that the question, why do men kill themselves, should be replaced by the question, why do men not kill themselves? And, of course, he puts it in French. And I read it at the age of 16 in English and haven't looked at it since. So, really, I'm not guessing exactly because it's very clear in my memory, but hoping. Let's think of it that way. Hoping that my very clear memory of the opening sentences of the Myth of Sisyphus is correct. It certainly makes perfect sense to me now, is in fact the question I might have put to myself without reference to Camus if the memory of Camus hadn't intruded. What I'm doing here is stalling, because in fact I don't want to answer the question, why don't I commit suicide? After all, the best I can hope for is another day like this, of which the best that could be said is that I don't believe I've caused anyone any harm or done any damage in the world, as far as I know. I may have done incidental harm and damage quite unawares. I might, for example, have reminded somebody of somebody they had loved and lost, and stirred long and hitherto successfully repressed feelings, which then engulfed them. Or suppose she was driving by in a car, had glanced out of the window, and my face, my body posture, the dreary drum of my feet heading up Holland Park Avenue, had brought to her mind a husband, or a dog. Yes, more likely a dog that she buried a year ago. The dog that had been a mere pup when she had what? Her first child? Got married. Got arrested. Got her driving licence. Does one remember dogs as pups anyway? I don't think so. I think one remembers them, carries them about in one's heart, as full-grown dogs with their characters firmly established. Besides, if it was the sight of me plodding up Holland Park Avenue that reminded her of her dog, it would scarcely be of a puppy, would it, that I reminded her. It would be of an elderly dog, the equivalent of a 70-year-old man, which would be a 420-year-old dog, if you multiply by six to translate dog years to human years. Which can't be right. It's clearly nonsensical, in fact. A 420-year-old dog would be a dead dog, surely, even in dog years. So have I got the multiplication factor wrong? Oh, but let's get back to the point I started from, which is whether I might have done unintended harm today by reminding a woman driving past me on Holland Park Avenue of a beloved husband or dog, now dead. There. That puts it all very clearly. She saw me. Into her head surged a memory of her dead husband going about a particularly beloved piece of business. What? My imagination fails me. I can't make up a beloved piece of husbandly business. I seem to picture him coming out of the lavatory, shuffling out, doing up his belt. Not much hope that you'll remember that as a beloved bit of business, but possibly its very characteristicness will have something lovable about it, perhaps just its regularity. Every morning, on the stroke of eight, I see him coming out of the lavatory. He had a way of fumbling with his belt, such a way of fumbling with his belt, it was so him. She may, of course, remember it, particularly the regularity, with revulsion, in which case he would be likely to be, in all his aspects, unbeloved by her. Surely there are other bits of business you can give him that don't have lavatorial associations, and that she might remember with, well, a degree of affection, at least. He's remembered with a degree of affection. Might be a decent enough epitaph, come to that. It's certainly more precise and therefore more convincing than beloved, which is what I put on my brother Piers's tombstone. Now, when I sit on the bench opposite his grave and look at the word, it no longer seems simple and eloquent, but brutal and pretentious. I used to distract myself from it by getting up and walking around for a while, and then pausing in front of one of the graves 8 down from Piers, on the right, as you face him. Actually, I described it somewhere else. Headstone is rather jaunty, yellowy-grey in colour, with a photograph of a young man embedded in a little glass dome at the top. He's bareheaded, dark hair cut short, round, handsome face with slightly childlike features, unformed anyway, as if he hasn't grown into them yet. He's dressed in shiny black leather, mounted on a powerful motorbike, a helmet under one arm, the other resting on the handlebars. Underneath this is inscribed, "In loving memory of Andrew Crabb." And underneath that, "A dear son, brother and friend." And underneath that, "Born 12th February 1963, died 10th April 1996. And underneath that is written in curling, flourishy letters the following poem. "He rode through life fast and free, his candle burning bright, and through the smoke that we still pass, he left us with his light." Once, when I worked out from his dates that he was just 2 days short of 33 years and 2 months old when he smashed himself up on his motorbike, I suddenly became interested in this question of ages, how long the dead in Piers's vicinity had spent in the world. I suppose I must have checked on about 15 gravestones and found two, both men, on which the arithmetic worked out at 49, the age Piers was when he died. Altogether, 3 out of 16, if one included Piers. Must be unusual, surely, a freak clustering. Clustering, isn't that the right word, the word they use when compiling statistics of this sort? Now a new grave has come between Andrew Crabb and Piers, of a woman who, like Andrew Crabb, died in her 30s, and on the tombstone which marks it there is a poem in italic letters. "Do not stand at my grave and weep. I am not here. I do not sleep. I am a thousand winds that blow. I am the softly falling snow." And above it, etched into the stone, is the figure of a woman who could be an angel or could be a nurse. It's so vaguely rather than delicately executed. I suppose the statement of the poem could be described as pantheistic, sentimental pantheistic. Anyway, it's certainly not Christian, and it's self-evidently untrue. You might even say that it's a lie, just as the nurse angel etching is a lie. She wasn't like that in life, and she isn't that in death. I wish I could remember her name. Her Christian name was Lillian. I'm sure of that. But why I mention her, or rather her tombstone, is that it always gives me comfort, because it speaks well of the feelings of the people, parents, I think, who buried her, and makes me feel less well about the people who buried my brother Piers. And if I exonerate my brother Nigel, who was in shock and not well, I am left with me as the family member I feel less well about, the unexonerated. I always slide some of the feeling on Lillian's tombstone onto Piers's, although he would never have thought of himself as softly falling snow, or as a thousand winds that blow. Furthermore, he might well have wanted me to stand at his grave and weep, but to what avail, as he is to be found, if he is to be found anywhere, at the still point of the turning world, which is where I plonked him, according to the line I had inscribed on the bench. Furthermore, I attributed the line, as if to give it added value, to T.S. Eliot. "Piers Gray, at the still point of the turning world, T.S. Eliot." Lillian's lines, unattributed, seem simply to have drifted down and settled on her tombstone. When I say them aloud, I don't say them directly to Piers, of course, as that would be a sort of thieving. I say them almost directly towards Lillian, but keep Piers in the corners of my eyes.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.